Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren along with my usual co-host Doug Wells, flying co-pilot today. And we have a fun show today, something for everyone. We'll be talking about pets and fine art photography and risk in the business world. We'll talk about risk first.
All right. And then speaking of risk, there's always a risk when you go on vacation or what's going to happen with your pets. And we're going to be speaking with the folks from the Park City Resort, which has opened up a new facility over at Silver Creek. And from the description of it, it sounds like resort is the right name for it.
The Park City Pet Resort.
The Park City Pet Resort. Thank you. And then our final guests are going to be Jared and Trish McMillan of the McMillan Gallery. They're going to come in and talk to us and give us an update of what's happening in the art world here in Park City. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Bob Dillon, a lawyer in the Park City office of Jones Waldo with 38 years of legal experience in complex real estate transactions. Proud supporters of KPCW, Jones Waldo provides local businesses with legal services in areas ranging from real estate to employment law. Our website is joneswaldo.com.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Did you know that by shopping locally, you're supporting trail maintenance, our free bus system, and the many wonderful cultural and recreational opportunities in our community? When you shop or dine in Summit County, those dollars stay right here in Summit County. The Park City Chamber Bureau is pleased to support KPCW's locally grown radio show, Mountain Money. Remember, keep it local, keep it PC. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
And welcome back to Mountain Money, and we have Karan Garotra on the line with us. And Karan has written the book, The Risk-Driven Business Model, Four Questions That Will Define Your Company. And Karan is a professor at and you'll have to correct my pronunciation here, INSEAD University, which is a graduate school for business that operates on three continents, in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East, also in the U.S., affiliated with the Wharton Graduate School of Business. And the book is for entrepreneurs and company executives in fast-changing industries. Welcome to Mountain Money, Karan.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about INSEAD. Or I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. But
I'll take a guess at it too. INSEAD?
INSEAD.
Okay. Well. First, tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll get into the book.
Right. So INSEAD is we're a global business school, mostly offering a graduate education, like you said, MBA programs, and also a lot of what we do is programs for organizations, such as an executive education program for folks who might be working in a particular organization but need some specific help targeted at a certain subject. We like to think of ourselves as perhaps one of the most global schools. We have campuses, like you said, in three different locations, and these are places where our faculty are based. And that's mostly it. So we're a global business school focused on issues of global interest.
And Karan, just to add a little bit to that, my understanding is for students that are interested in international business, like if an American student was interested in international business, INSEAD would probably be one of the top three schools in the world that they would hope to get into if they were applying.
Definitely, no. In most kind of rankings for what they're worth, outside the U.S., the school will probably be rated as the top school.
Right. So let's transition into your book now. So the title of your book is the Risk-Driven Business Model, and start off talking to us about your view of risk. And when you talk risk-driven, what do you mean by risk?
Right. So risk is often thought of as a bad thing, something which really is something we should avoid, something we should stay away from in business. But as any businessman knows, risk is part and parcel of any business. Our view in the book is not looking at risk as something that one should be afraid of, but really as an opportunity. Our central thesis is that one way of disrupting the industry, one way of doing better than anyone else in the industry, one way of changing the game in your industry, is to change your business model, in particular, change it in terms of how it deals with risk. And so we think of risk in industries as an opportunity to really innovate yourself from different organizations and create something which is going to have a significant advantage over others. And the best thing I think to remember about this is sometimes when I always said you want to create a business model which manages risk better. This might at times mean having more risk than the original model, as long as you're being paid sufficiently for it. So for us, risk is an opportunity and an important, previously overlooked lever to improve your business model on.
Well, does risk correlate with profit? The more risk you take, the more profit you stand to gain, or does it mean the more risk you take, the more you stand to crash spectacularly?
I know. So it doesn't directly correlate. It correlates in a little more subtle way. So a firm that better manages risk is certainly going to have better profits. See, the goal is not to take risk comes with the goal is to improve your risk return trade-off. Let me give an example to perhaps illustrate this a little bit better. One industry where we've seen a risk-driven business model completely change the game is the apparel industry. So about perhaps 6, 8, 10 years back, most apparel was made, and even today, with the vast majority of the apparel manufacturers would make their apparel in Asia. Historically, China, today perhaps a little more Bangladesh, Vietnam. Now, this model requires you to make decisions on what you're going to make perhaps about a year or so before these clothes show up in the store shelves. Now, that's great. You get great prices the costs are very low in producing in far-off locations. But it comes with one caveat. Because you've got to make these things a year in advance, you kind of a year in advance have to guess what styles are going to catch on, what colors are going to be hot, what cuts are going to be good, what is really going to be in vogue in a year's time. And that is how most apparel manufacturers used to work. Very often, because they were guessing a year in advance, they would get their bets wrong. They would either make too much of a certain style or too little of a style. If they make too much of it, it would lead to discounting. And as everyone knows, today there's a lot more deals or a lot more discounting in the apparel sector than it used to be. And most of it is driven from making these decisions long in advance. In particular, this business model is faced to the risk of not knowing what's going to sell. And that's the way things were done. So, then comes in a competitor, a different company, which really changes the game here. The company I have in mind is Zara, which introduced this notion of fast fashion. What does Zara do? Zara comes in and challenges one of the central tenets in this industry. That is, we've got to produce cheaply, we've got to reduce costs by going to Asia. They say no. We're going to produce at that time in southern Europe, and that clearly comes at much higher cost. But it comes with a huge advantage. They need to make this decision of producing clothes only about 2 weeks before the clothes show up in the shelves. Mostly because for two reasons. One, because they're producing in Europe, they can get things shipped very fast. And second, they don't want to get the lowest price. Their whole focus is on choosing suppliers who can get things quickly to them. They do that, and now they're making their bets only 2 weeks before the clothes show up on the market. In particular, their risk is a lot less than that of a traditional apparel manufacturer. And lo and behold, the rest is history. Zara can consistently produce things which are very trendy. It can consistently get in the shelves things which in fact sometimes even much higher end brands who might have conceptualized the new trend cannot respond to it fast enough, but Zara can. And since for the last 15, 20 years, Zara has grown aggressively around the world, particularly in Europe and to some extent in the U.S., and has really grabbed a lot of this market, without offering any deals or sales, all while using very expensive local production.
Hey, Karan? So let me you have another example in your book of Apple computers. And you mentioned the difference of business models between iTunes, which sells per song, and Spotify, which offers a subscription service. And I want to use that as a transition into Apple computers and the example you just gave, because as painful as it is to have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars of inventory of apparel,
right.
Imagine what Apple's doing right now with the iPhone 6 that, you know, who knows, people think is coming out in September. They're going to produce tens of millions of these iPhone 6s with having done few, if any, focus groups.
Right.
It is the most bizarre business model. Now, they've been very successful with it to date, but at some point, if they swing and miss and think they're coming up with a product that America right. and the rest of the world doesn't want, they've got a huge supply chain and inventory of these phones.
Right.
Why do you think that the smartphone industry has evolved that way, as opposed to they could have borrowed Dell's model? Clearly, yeah. Apple's been much more successful than Dell. But where they kind of build to order and only fill a little bit of inventory and make people wait 3 days for their phone. Why do you think it's come out that way?
No, that's a great question. First, I think you're right that Apple so far has been mostly lucky, but not fully lucky. They've had misses too. Maybe not in the smartphone category, but stuff like Apple TV. In the music player business, they had certain generations of the iPod, particularly the smaller version of it, that didn't really fly. Even in the last generation, they had the iPhone 5C, which everyone was calling them to produce a slightly cheaper phone, didn't really excel as much as they were hoping it would. In fact, and many times they have the problem on the other side, not making enough of a certain product, and then having, again, customers waiting or defecting to other things. So I think they've been not very successful, not consistently successful, but they have been successful with this model more than one would have imagined. And I think to me the contrast between Dell and Apple lies in understanding how Apple has reframed the concept of the smartphone. So when Dell was making computers and doing very well with it, it really was a more B2B. Not really a consumer product, it was mostly a business product. Now, business folks were willing to wait 3 months. Apple converted these electronic devices into really consumer goods that everyone really wants, into impulse purchases at some extent. And when you come to this model, sometimes inventory is helpful to really have something physical that customers can see and perhaps buy, even if they had not planned to do.
It really is.
The reason why Apple has done well. Before I end, I do want to mention another company in the smartphone space which is not doing this and doing actually very well. This company is Xiaomi. This is an Asian company which makes smartphones, cheaper smartphones than what Apple makes, but with a very different model. They don't do this once a year, big mega launch of iPhone X with a lot of new features. They typically introduce phones much more often, and after they introduce them, they listen to customers and keep improving them. So typically you'd get a software update every end of the week, and you'd have new features based on exactly what the customers want. It has been it's only a four-year-old company, a four- or five-year-old company now. They've done exceedingly well. Multi-billion dollars in sales, and in the lower-end smartphone category, they're challenging every existing manufacturer.
Karan?
With a different model of listening to folks and responding, rather than really the Apple model of we know what is good and really making a big bet.
Great. Let me go to another event that's been in the news recently. Microsoft's new CEO, Satya Nadella, sent out a letter to his organization last week. Several-page letter, very well thought out, very well written. I don't know, did you have a chance to read it by chance?
Right, yes, to some extent.
Okay, so I would think in your business, that letter is a great example of, you know, how do you get buy-in from the organization? How do you set the vision and then get the organization behind it? You talk about in a big organization in your book, the challenge of getting a large group of people all driving in the same direction. You have an example of, I think it was a bank that has 250,000 employees, and you're training 500 employees a year, but still that's a very small fraction.
Right.
But I wanted your thoughts. What did you think of Satya's letter, where he basically said, we're going to focus on mobile, we're going to focus on cloud, we're going to focus on productivity, and by the way, Wall Street, we're not going to get rid of the Xbox, so quit asking us to.
Exactly.
What did you think of that letter?
So to me, that letter was a harbinger of bigger changes. So it was really setting the ground that we are going to make some changes in the way we do things, not just in the focus areas, but also how we develop stuff. We've got to get faster. We've got to get leaner in doing it. We've got to test things a little bit before we make big, big commitments and big bets in certain directions. And to me, that letter was more a call for what's going to happen next. So I believe we'll hear more from Microsoft on how this vision is actually going to be translated into reality, in particular on certain issues. So first, I think Microsoft, with recent acquisitions of phone manufacturers, others, has another 20,000 employees or so than they had just even a couple of years back. So some organizational changes will need to happen there. Second, I do believe that beyond just what you mentioned already, focusing on the right areas, Microsoft and Satya's big challenge is making it a fast-responding organization. So it doesn't take a year before it realizes what hit it, which has happened in multiple categories. It launches a product with multiple self-imposed blunders, like what happened with Windows 8.0. So I think he's going to try to make the organization much more responsive, and this letter is really setting the stage that this is what is coming, and get ready for it a little bit. That's the sense I got by. That's the meaning I saw behind the words.
Yeah, you know, he was fairly stern there, too. I mean, one of the notes he says to his employees, and I'm paraphrasing a bit here, is you will be asked to come up with new and better ways of doing things and enthusiastically driving the changes. And there was an undertone there, basically get on board with this new direction, or you know what, Microsoft's probably not the right place for you to work.
Right. No, Microsoft for too long has become a large bureaucracy, which is not going to get it very far in a model, in an industry like the one it operates in. I think the example, this happens to all big companies. They end up in these situations, and it's particularly harmful in a fast-moving industry where employees also have a certain desire to be more creative, more innovative than in most where the mostly young workforce is quite inspired by being given the freedom to make change.
Well, Karan, we thank you for joining us this morning. Your book is The Risk-Driven Business Model, 4 Questions That Will Define Your Company. Thank you for joining us on Mountain Money this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll come back and talk about the Park City Pet Resort in just a moment. Looking at the weather, boy, it's going to be like over 100 in the valley and perhaps as high as 87 up here today under mostly sunny skies. Chance of a thunderstorm toward evening, and all day tomorrow a chance of thunderstorms, but it's going to be another hot one tomorrow with a high of about 85. So when we come back, we're going to talk about Park City's favorite subject other than skiing and mountain biking, and that is pets.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. In studio with us now is David Elvenhall and Annie Elvenhall as well.
Annie Elliott.
Annie Elliott, my bad.
That's okay.
Right. There it is right there.
You just married him. And
I was going to ask, how is it to work together? But that question's off the table now. And you guys are with Park City Pet Resort. Tell us a little bit about where Park City Pet Resort is and what your facility and services are like.
We're in Silver Creek, right over by the gas station, just right in back of there. We've been open for, about 2 weeks, mm-hmm. 2 weeks now, and we house up to 43 animals at a time. We can. We like to keep it small while we're there.
And do you guys do, so I have a Labrador, like half of the people here in Park City.
Right.
And, you know, Labradors are pretty easy because they get along with most dogs. But I know when we've used kennel services in the past, when we've used pet watching services in the past, mm-hmm. they want to interview the dog to make sure the dog's going to fit in with everybody else. Do you guys do that? And then how do you handle the more challenging dogs?
Well, we'd like to have them come in for daycare when they come in and the first initial greeting when they first come in. We could tell by playing with them, and then we encourage them to come over for a daycare day to see how they handle the situation with other dogs. And then we keep them in a small group, which makes it a lot easier for us to watch them and take care of them, make sure everyone's safe.
We also really pride ourselves on having a lot of options. We have options where the dogs can, if it's not appropriate for them to be in group play, we certainly are equipped to take them for walks, and we have a large property so they can get out. So, you know, our goal is when you're on vacation, we want your pet to be on vacation as well. And we do our best to try to work, you know, with any idiosyncrasy or kind of situation just to make that happen.
Well, now, by pet, are you talking dogs only, or what's the range of animals you can take care of?
We have cats, and we actually currently have a fish.
A fish?
Yes,
we do.
Came in its own tank?
Yes, he did, and Finn is residing very comfortably at the pet resort, and we also have a couple of kitties, and of course, our main clientele are going
well,
to be dogs.
Well, keep the cats away from the fish.
We do. Okay. We do. We keep everybody has their own little area, so we all get along.
Not mixing species here.
So, you know, it's funny, when you go downtown Salt Lake City, and 600 South, there's two pet kennel resort type places. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought, I mean, we do have places where you can drop off your dog, but we don't have many resort type, you know, a higher end, better, you know, large open space. I think there's one at the top of Daly Street, but other than that, we really don't have a lot of those. So as you guys did your market research and thought about opening a facility here, how did the Park City community look from a business standpoint?
We love our dogs. And we love to travel. And so
it's
perfect.
And that's all the market research you needed?
Really? Well, you know, we're dog owners, and I know from personal experience, you know, travel can be difficult. You know, and even, you know, short trips or day trips, you know, want to ski and go out and you have guests, you know, that can be a difficult situation. And of course, we all enjoy the outdoors, and sometimes it's just not appropriate to take our pets. So, you know, seeing this facility and seeing the options that we could provide there, you know, really, truly was an easy fit.
And you guys have 7,000 square feet of indoor space. So was that an existing building, and what was there before?
It was equine center.
We're housing what was formerly the Mountain Horse Medical Center. So there's actually one home and two large buildings on that property. And so we still have the equine surgical center that eventually will be suitable for equine services, but right now we have what was formerly the horse stalls now converted into the kennel, so it provides us with a great area.
So how much time do pets, we'll talk about dogs mostly, spend in individual kennels as opposed to socially in groups? Are they all assigned their own space for part of the day?
Great question. That's asked a lot when we have the clients come in, how long are they going to stay in the kennels? We base it on feeding time they'll be in there during their time where they sleep, and then we have the
plate. Which really for a dog is like 23 hours a day they sleep. It's really amazing how much a dog sleeps.
You know, it is amazing. It's unlike cats, you know, which are fairly easy to take care of and monitor. But I would say they spend a majority of the time out in the play area, a good hour. We offer out in the play area. Then we have the 2-3 20-minute walks that we have for them. And that's out in a 7.5-acre facility
and
with the trails.
Who does the walks? Are you hiring high school kids to do that? Or
actually, myself and another staff member, Cameron, that we have there with Carly. So we all take
you know,
that job and duties.
Is a big business here in Park City.
And
well.
It is art.
It
some,
is.
Some of the people who do it, to have the ability to keep them all kind of focused and together rather
and tangle
than
free
and
right.
tangle free rather than all going off in 12 directions is an art.
You know, when my kids were younger, we were at a soccer game and one of the moms there, I was asking her what she does, and she's a professional dog walker here in Park City, and I was surprised she was doing actually really, really well doing it. In fact, my daughter started walking dogs after talking to her. Mm-hmm. She's like, well, if she can do it, I can do it too.
Yeah, we've got, like I said, for me, it's great to get outdoors, and
sure.
the exercise is fantastic. And, you know, we spend a lot of time outdoors. So usually when we walk dogs, we typically don't take, like I wouldn't take two at a time. I take one. So
are you keeping them on a leash for security, or is your property secure, the 7.5 acres?
Our daycare is secure with the fence, an 8-foot fence. Outside of that area, everyone's required to have a leash, and we have a GPS collar that's attached to each
smart
dog. And that's we have an app on our phone, so we're it's an extra precaution just in case something happens, we can track them down.
Speaking of GPS on the collars, do you guys have like the cameras so mom and dad can check and see how
absolutely.
The dogs? How did I
you
guess?
Gotta
how
have
did that.
That. Yeah, you gotta yeah. have it.
That's funny.
You could see it on your phone. We have an app on your phone where you can, wherever you're at, you can check on your
now
phone.
Do you guys offer an outreach program as well? If somebody says, you know, I want to leave my dog here, but I want somebody to come to my house, will you guys do that service as well?
We don't. Right now, we are really just focusing on dogs that are dropped off and stay at our facility, either on a daycare basis or a boarding basis.
Now, a part of your group also includes a veterinarian, right?
That's correct.
So does that mean with Carl Pryor? So does
correct.
That mean this is offered the pet resort in conjunction with veterinary services?
Well, right now we don't have a clinic per se set up out at the resort, but we do have Dr. Pryor and the other veterinarians that work at Park City Animal Clinic on call to us at any time. They are also out at the pet resort. So if there's any concerns at all, we've got someone right there and can address any issues pretty much immediately.
Now you've only been open a couple of weeks, so maybe you don't have the experience yet to know, but is there a certain point at which the dog becomes homesick for the parent, or do they quickly forget about their old master and enjoy the new world of the pet resort?
You know, we have some dogs are long-term there. I have some that are here for till the 29th. It takes a few days for them to acclimate to our facility, and usually within about that time, they're great. So they're happy. They're playing out in the run area. So yeah, they do fine.
And each dog is a little different, and that's why you know having some experience, both Dave and I, coming from a background of small animal care, you know, you can try to tailor things. You know, do they need a little extra play time? They need a little walk, or do we need to tire them out? But you know, those are all things that really you do have to watch for because every dog's individual.
Yeah, I can tell you, my dog, who's ever feeding my dog, is their best friend, and they quickly forget who my wife, my kids, and I are. So you just mentioned your background. So what were you guys doing before joining the pet resort?
Well, for me, I am in the field of more holistic pet care. I'm a certified canine massage provider, and I use that within conjunction of the field of canine rehabilitation. So I work with dogs that have had orthopedic injuries or surgeries and help them regain their gait. And I work with Park City Animal Clinic, and that is how my association with the Park City Pet Resort came about.
Interesting. And how about you, Dave?
Myself, before this, I was with I learned the grooming aspect of this for 4.5 years. So I trained in that, and then I opened up my own pet sitting business for quite a few years.
We go into people's homes?
Yes, we go to people's homes, right, and we do that. And that worked out very well. So coming to this resort we have now, we're trying to make it so it's very comfortable for the pets to be there, not just a block building with, you know, we want to make it like they feel like they're at home.
Okay. Annie, it's a slight diversion, but I want to go back to what you were doing before.
Sure. I still do that.
The pet massage. Because I've heard of it, I've seen it. In fact, my wife has said, gee, I wonder if our dog Crystal would benefit from that. And I got to admit, the first time she said that, I chuckled. She's a healthy dog. It's just my wife likes massages, and she wanted to give her dog something that she likes as well. So do you go to massage? Were you doing human massages first, and then you transferred to dog massage?
Well, actually, in order to be certified, you do have to be nationally certified in human massage. So I had to go to school and become a nationally licensed human massage therapist and then continue my education for a canine-specific work.
Was that always the goal, to do the canine work?
Absolutely.
It was. Wow.
Yeah.
So that's a long path.
Yeah, it was.
Massage school is over a year, isn't it?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. But it was, you know, I was luckily at a time in my life where I could kind of indulge this interest, and it's been great. And of course, again, we live in a place where everybody has had orthopedic surgeries or gone to rehab or physical therapy. So using massage techniques and the same techniques that we are used to having on their dogs is such an easy transfer. It's not a hard sell here in Park City. And I highly encourage it, because, of course, touching your dog, you get to know what's normal, what's not normal. You find little things when they're little as opposed to being big. And so I'm a big fan, and it certainly is something that increases the bond with either your cat or dog.
Now, of course, Park City is a dog town, but let's not forget cats. So cats are more solitary animals. So are your cats all segregated when you get them? Do they stay?
They are.
They're by themselves?
They're in the house. I have a separate area for them. So there's a kennel set up for them in the far end of the house where I reside. I live there on the property. So they're completely separate. We decided to do that to just safety reasons and everything else.
That sounds like a good idea, to keep the cats and dogs as well as the cats and the fish separate.
Yeah,
you also have Finn the fish.
Yes,
this
we do.
Must be one pampered fish.
Well, you know, fish are family too sometimes, Larry. So we're doing our best to make sure that Finn has a wonderful vacation while his folks are away as well.
What about zoning, getting the place approved? Were you guys involved in that? And was it difficult to get that facility approved? I think you said 40-plus dogs you can have at the facility.
It's 43 we have, and it was difficult.
How close is it? I know that area, and I think it's pretty far from the nearest house. Is that correct?
We're pretty separated. I mean, you'd be surprised. And that was the main issue, was the noise factor that was the problem,
right,
along with a few others. But I was able to meet with a lot of the neighbors, along with Dr. Pryor. And after opening up and talking with everybody, it went really well. So we have no issues there.
Okay. Well, our guests this morning have been David Elvenhall and Annie Elliott of Park City Pet Resort. You guys have opened up 2 weeks ago. If you folks are leaving on vacation, this is a busy time of year. It's a new facility. Go check them out over by Silver Creek. Thank you for coming in this morning.
And you have a website?
We do. We have a website, and we certainly welcome anybody to come out and visit and see the facility and bring their dog.
Okay. Another great new business in Park City. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Jared and Trish McMillan. We had them in a year ago when they opened their first gallery. Now they're opening a second. So clearly they found a niche in Park City. And we'll talk about McMillan Fine Art Photography after this. And good luck with the pet resort.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, guys.
This is Sean Railton. I'm an agent with Park City Realty Group. I'm a 30-year Park City resident and a KPCW underwriter. I have been involved in the Park City real estate market since 1994 as an agent, an appraiser, and an investor. I can be reached at 649-1991 or Sean at parkcityrealtygroup.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, parkcitynursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. In studio with us now is Jared and Trish McMillan of McMillan Galleries. When we talked to you last time, you guys had just opened a gallery over at the Redstone. It's a year later, and I understand you're opening a second gallery here in Park City. Tell us about that gallery.
You know, it's already open, actually. So we're at 511 Main, and it's not a huge gallery, so it's kind of a nice, cozy little space, but we've got lots of artwork in there, and it's been really well-received by the Park City community, so that's just been amazing.
And very similar selection to what you have at Redstone, or different focus?
Different pieces, actually. We've got a little bit here and a little bit there.
Yeah, it's a little more local-oriented up here, like local stuff, more right. of the Wasatch and lots of aspen trees and stuff like that.
Now, describe your focus. Is it all landscape? Do you do wildlife? Are you taking natural scenes and enhancing them, photoshopping them, or just tell us how you work?
Well, we shoot on medium and large format film cameras. So we shoot on a lot of our images are
film cameras.
Film cameras, yeah. Okay. We shoot 120 millimeter film on our panoramic cameras. So all of our panoramics are shot on an actual panoramic camera, which is kind of cool. And then our more square rectangular pieces are shot on a 4x5 camera, which is a large format camera that shoots sheet film. So basically, once our film is shot, goes through the processing stages, and then our prints are actually an emulsion-based print, so a traditional darkroom print. So we'll do some color correcting, but other than that, they're au natural. There's no Photoshop work that goes into our stuff.
This is old school.
Yeah, old right. school. Old school, yeah. I mean, our large format cameras, like what Ansel Adams used to shoot with, which is pretty cool.
That's very cool. And if I recall from our conversation last time, you guys had a studio or were doing some work in Las Vegas as well and also working up here. Are you still doing the work in Las Vegas or are you primarily 100% here now?
I'm probably in Vegas about 7 to 10 days a month and the studio there is just doing amazingly. So it's an awesome business. It's just doing really, really well.
Now, Vegas is obviously a tourist town as well.
Yeah.
How does the art scene, what type of art, I mean, obviously there's a lot of mountain landscape here, a lot of aspens. What's the art scene in Vegas? What sells there?
You know, we actually have a collection of images shot at the Neon Museum, which is where they take all the old Las Vegas signs basically to restore them, and it's kind of a graveyard sense. But we have a fine art license to go in there and photograph the signs, excuse me, and then sell them as fine art. So we've got some hotels that collect those pieces, which is kind of cool.
Okay,
and
so
they're
completely different.
I can't think of anything more different than a screaming Vegas neon sign and a quiet aspen grove in the Wasatch Mountains.
Exactly. Very, very different. Very yeah. different. But, I mean, the museum is a pretty unique museum. And, I mean, it's worth visiting if you're ever down there. And it's super colorful, super punchy. And it kind of fits in with more modern decor with a lot of the newer casinos down there, which is, they look awesome when they're hung.
Yeah.
So do those sell up here? Do you ever try putting the Vegas neon in your Redstone gallery find buyers?
Actually, almost all the pieces we put in the gallery here have sold.
Really?
Yeah. They're kind of this funky, urban sort of, you know, like beaten up kind of look to the signs. If you can imagine a bunch of signs stacked on top of each other. So you've got crashed up bulbs and all kinds of funky things going on with color. So they actually add an amazing splash of color. So a lot of people really like them. And there's a lot of folks up here from Vegas. You know, they just want a little
especially
touch of
especially this
home.
Time of year when it's 110
yeah.
degrees.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's why we're
yeah,
here.
I mean, I think the first four pieces that we brought in from our bulbs collection, it's called, I think they found a home within like 4 or 5 days.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of psychology to art, too. Mm-hmm. I'm always amazed. One of the things when I visit different towns and, you know, if we're at a place where we have several friends in a town, it's amazing the similarities of the art that people choose to put in their house. It's very different. My brother-in-law got married two or three years ago when Washington when it was legal to have gay marriage in Washington D.C. We went out there for his wedding. Went to five or six houses, and the thing that struck me was it was all political artwork. It was all, you know, portraits of presidents or powerful political leaders, and everybody had a family story with the connection. And when I moved here to Park City, it was just amazing because everybody had, you know, aspen groves somewhere in their house. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird. I like aspen trees, but I don't think I'd ever put a picture of them in my house. And you know what?
You can look out the window and see enough of them.
I have pictures of aspen groves in my house now, and I love them. So I think there's definitely a social influence to the art that we choose to put in our houses. Yeah. Do you agree?
I totally agree. And I also think, too, people move to Park City because they want that beautiful, natural landscape environment. And what's cool about our artwork is because it's hand-poured acrylic, it really almost feels like a window in your home. So if you've got a darker space, it's a really, really great environment to add one of those vibrant, colorful aspen pieces. So, but I do think people are influenced by that. That's why they
come. Well, you know, it reminds me of a story the late Jim Santee told me, which is, you know how you can tell people love Park City. So in any other city, do you find in people's houses pictures of their city in their house? If you visit That's somebody true. In Canton, Ohio, are they going to have a Canton picture in their house?
Right.
Probably
right.
not. But try walking in any Park City house and not finding some kind of framed representation of Park City on the walls. It's just that kind of town.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, what we found is people actually want to bring it to their other homes if they live in Texas or Florida or whatever. I mean, it's
they
you'd be
it
surprised
here.
How many pieces of aspen pieces that we ship around the
now,
world.
I'm curious from a business standpoint, when you opened your first studio in Redstone, was your goal to find something on Main Street initially and there was nothing available, so you said, let's go to the Redstone, we'll open something on Main Street later, or how did that play out?
You know, it's kind of interesting. We came here about, I guess it was 8 years ago for our honeymoon. And the year before we had come here also, and I think it was the year that Redstone opened, and we actually stayed there on vacation. And we loved the fact that we could walk across the street and go to Whole Foods, and basically we were close to everything that we wanted to do in the outdoors and fishing and all that kind of stuff. And then we were like, this area is going to boom. It's gonna happen, and it's going to be a great spot. And so we actually chose the space at Redstone because we love the area, which worked out really well. And then what happened was, as the time passed, we were both like, wow, you know, downtown really does get a significant amount of traffic, you know, and you do want that tourist traffic as well because it does influence the success of the business. So, and that's what happened was basically we just kind of kept looking and something came up and, you know.
Is it pretty tight on Main Street now? I would think it is, but
it is.
I don't know.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, the merchants there are really supportive and it's really a great environment to do business because everybody is really geared towards success.
Is there a I don't know, saturation point of galleries on Main Street that feature fine art photography and especially landscapes? There are quite a few when you go up and down the street.
There are quite a few, but I mean, honestly, I think our stuff is completely different compared to what else is hanging. And I mean, it's proven in our collectors. I mean, as soon as somebody comes in and invests in a piece, 80%, 90% chance they're going to come back. And we have clients that every time they come to town, they come in and they invest in a piece.
Acquire one more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you go to Mangelson and you get the wildlife photography. You go to Fatali and you get the red rock. Willie Holdman specializes in, the Wasatch and big landscapes. And how would you describe your landscapes?
Fine art. Fine art landscapes. If that's a difference, I mean,
a little more.
Well, I mean, you know, I think that's really the way I describe it. It's a fine art photograph, and I think there's a really big difference between a picture, a photograph, and a fine art photograph. And it's, I mean, a lot of work goes into what we do. It's not like we're going out shooting 2,000 pictures and going through all the digital, you know, files. I mean, we're going out to make one fine art photograph and that's it.
Let me switch gears a little bit too. I noticed, I think it was a couple months ago on the Park Record, you guys did a fundraiser with Ferberbia.
Yeah.
And Ferberbia, my daughter's very involved with Ferberbia. She's here Saturday morning talking about the dogs that are available for adoption. And when you do a fundraiser like that, obviously the people that are coming to that love dogs, love cats. Do you change the artwork that's out there for that audience, or do you leave the, does the artwork stay the same?
Actually, we did something really cool this year. We actually photographed horses, which is something that we have really never done, mostly because I think we've just never been inspired by it. But I think being out here with all the open space and these huge vistas and giant skies, it's kind of wonderful to get these horses in this environment where it's, you can really focus on their character. Mm-hmm. And when we did the opening of the new space, we actually featured a horse portrait because our roots are portraits, obviously celebrity and professional athlete portraits. And so basically Jared had gone out and photographed a portrait that we call Warrior, and it's a horse, and it's just amazing.
Is this the Black Stallion?
It kind of, you know, it kind of feels a little bit like the Black Stallion. It's kind of got like that power behind it. It's just this amazing image. And the truth of it is, what I love about it is you can really see into that horse. I mean, you can kind of feel the power of this animal. And that was something that we were kind of like, you know, animals aren't exactly what we do. But we love animals, and that's why we do the fundraiser for Furburbia. But, you know, basically we really felt like it was a different genre for people that absolutely loved horses, dogs, any animals. You know, and it was really, really well received. So we were very surprised.
Yeah, so with that event, we brought in the first horse piece, and it was a huge hit. What we did is a percentage of proceeds went to Friends of Animals.
Right. Well, thank you for doing that. That's important work.
Yeah, we love animals.
So Jared, when you were filming these horses, I mean, it's always amazed me that my little girls, you know, when they're not so little anymore, but when they were younger, they just loved horses. And I got to be honest with you, they scare me. I mean, they are big animals.
They are big.
And they're very powerful. So when you were photographing them, were you fearful at all, or did you feel comfortable?
Like I said, we're shooting on a 4x5 camera.
He was fearful for his lens.
I'm more scared of moose than a horse.
Forget his life.
But no, I mean, we shot them on a 4x5 camera, which is our large format camera, which we don't shoot a lot of wildlife because it's nearly impossible to focus the camera. By the time it's focused,
they're gone.
The moose is gone or whatever. So the first 10 we brought into the collection, we shot during a snowstorm. So that way we knew the horses weren't going to be moving around and they're not going to be running around the fields, blah, blah, blah. So that allowed us to be way more patient and take way more time and actually capture them because they're not moving and they're not. So in terms of being scared, I necessarily not
they
so
were
much.
Moving.
Yeah.
They weren't flying hoofs.
I mean, no. Yeah, no, they're pretty.
That's what I was thinking, flying hoof into the lens.
Right, me too.
Hey, I've been chased off by moose before, and that's a little more scary.
We had a friend that has a horse property that asked us to watch their house and watch their horses when they were gone. And oh my goodness, that was a mistake. The horse would walk away, and it's kind of like, you know, my wife left the gate open, and the horse is walking towards the gate, and I don't want the horse going through the gate. I'm saying, stop, you know, no. Yeah. But it's not like a dog. You know? They don't listen to commands.
They don't want to stand in front of it.
So my wife ran and got the neighbor. And, of course, you know, she just took the belt off of her pants and wrapped it around the horse's neck and brought it in. It's like, oh, that would have been a good idea. I wish I had thought of that.
It's a big animal. How do you stop? I'm not going to get in front of it.
So, yeah,
well, the gallery is, the new gallery is where? On Main?
511 Main.
So place that between what and what?
So just a little bit towards Lower Main Street past the post office.
Okay. And the printing, do you do that or is that done by a lab somewhere else?
Well, we do some of it in our bigger pieces. Yeah, we source out and work with a company.
Okay. And then what's the price range?
Anywhere from $1,200 to some of our artist proofs are around $25,000.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So you have collectors who will come every, well, I guess you hope they come multiple times then.
We do hope.
But people do consider them fine art and pay a fine art price, and it will hang in their house forever. And what about the emulsions and the finishes on prints? You know, way back when, if you hung a print on a wall, over time it would lose its luster.
Well, yeah. So what we do, like I said, it's a traditional darkroom print. So it's the paper it's printed on. It's more of a film than a paper. So as it runs through the emulsion, the chemicals, light basically embeds the ink into the paper or the emulsion into the paper. So then it comes out exposed to light, and then it's permanently adhered into the paper. So we get a lot of UV or archival properties just from that. But we take it a step further, and then we finish off the pieces with acrylic, which is a UV protected acrylic. So hang them in the sun. You're looking at well over, well, couple hundred years.
So before we let you go, you mentioned that you your background, you guys started with portraits, some famous people. Give us some ideas of some of the folks you've done portraits of.
Kevin Durant, Danica Patrick.
Mike Tyson.
Andre Agassi.
Lots of interesting
people who cycle through Las Vegas.
Yeah, you know, Vegas is a hotbed for those kind of folks. So so well, somebody's got to shoot them with a camera.
Yeah, okay. Hopefully. well, very fine. Thanks for joining us. We wish you all the success in the world, and you're having it now, opening a second gallery at 511 Main Street, and you're on the web where?
www.mcmillanfineart.com.
Okay. And the original store still at Redstone.
Yep,
exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks, Trish and Jared, for joining us from McMillan Gallery, now with two locations. And we'll be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Each week on This Green Earth, we bring you interviews with experts on environmental topics from local to global.
We've brought you award-winning authors Richard Louvre, Alan Weissman, and Terry Tempest Williams.
Politicians like Robert Reich and Ralph Becker.
And scientists like Michael Mann and Paul Ehrlich.
That's This Green Earth, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. on KPCW.
Brought to you by Republic Services, Vail Resorts,
and Rocky Mountain Power.
Hello, my friends. This is Randy Barton with The Local View, weekdays, 3 p.m. to 7 p.m., only in Park City, only on KPCW Community Radio. Always informative, always entertaining. Local news from our award-winning news department, national news from NPR, the BBC with international headlines, and Marketplace, sponsored by Fisher Investments, Silver King Coffee, Mercer Automotive, and Heber Valley Tourism.
And welcome back to the final minutes of Mountain Money. I want to thank our guest, Karan Garotra, who had some interesting stories about risky businesses. David Elvenhall and Annie Elliott from Park City Pet Resort, and Jared and Trish McMillan from McMillan Gallery. Tomorrow at this time, it's going to be Chris and Nell with This Green Earth. And did you hear, just as we were sitting down to start this show, Doug, the Dow again went over the 17,000 mark, and interest rates are, I guess, remaining low for a while. So is it just continued good news?
It's kind of the Goldilocks. It's kind of the Goldilocks economy, right? It's not too strong. It's not too weak, at least here in the U.S. There's some concerns over Europe. You may have heard last week was actually kind of a volatile week for the market. There was actually a pretty tiny bank in Portugal that was having some problems, and people were worried about, you know, is this going to be like a couple years ago with Greece, where there was the potential meltdown down there. And, you know, the reality is there's going to be things that are going to scare us, but have a long-term strategy. Think through that. Make sure you got the right long-term strategy. And then try to stay the course, because there's going to be good news. There's going to be bad news out there. But overall, I think things are pretty good shape.
You know, you take a wider view than those of us who just live in Utah. And here we see construction cranes all over and booming business and one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country.
3.6%. I mean, how much lower can it get here in Utah?
I mean, it's just extraordinary. Is the whole nation participating in this recovery, or is Utah ahead of the charge here?
I think we're ahead of the charge, although I think it's becoming more and more inclusive as the years go by. There's still pockets of weakness. Obviously, folks in Detroit are still having a hard time. The Rust Belt's still having a hard time. But overall, there's some nice growth out there.
Good, good. Well, next week on Mountain Money, we're going to have Meredith Ferguson, who's written a book on toxic workplaces. And that's not toxic chemicals. It's the atmosphere created in workplaces, and everybody's Doug.
Unfortunately, we've had
situations like that with maniacal bosses and the like. So we will learn about that subject, and then we're going to have some fun. We're going to switch it up and talk to an old friend of mine, old reporter pal from the Salt Lake Tribune, who has given up the journalist life to be a writer of books, and he's out with his fourth book now on Tuscany. He specializes in Italy and spends much of his time there.
That sounds like a pretty nice
writing about Italy. And I wanted to talk to him about the business of publishing, because it's not so rosy right now. But there are places for people like John Cahey, who has written Hidden Tuscany. So we'll have John in to talk about his latest book. And I want to thank our great sponsors, the Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough. Don't forget Chris and Nell back here tomorrow with This Green Earth. And this is KPCW in Park City. And we thank you for joining us at this 9 o'clock hour for Mountain Money.